The 15th Law. Crush your enemy totally. Judgment. All great leaders since Moses have known that a feared enemy must be crushed completely. Sometimes they have learned this the hard way. If one ember is left alight, no matter how dimly it smolders, a fire will eventually break out. More is lost through stopping halfway than through total annihilation. The enemy will recover and will seek revenge. Crush him. Not only in body, but in spirit. Transgression of the law. No rivalry between leaders is more celebrated in Chinese history than the struggle between Shang Yu and Liu Meng. These two generals began their careers as friends, fighting on the same side. Shang Yu came from the nobility. Large and powerful, given to bouts of violence and temper, a bit dull-witted, he was yet a mighty warrior who always fought at the head of his troops. Liu Meng came from peasant stock. He had never been much of a soldier, and preferred women and wine to fighting. In fact, he was something of a scoundrel. But he was wily, and he had the ability to recognize the best strategists, keep them as his advisers, and listen to their advice. He had risen in the army through these strengths. In 208 BC, the king of Chu sent two massive armies to conquer the powerful kingdom of Qin. One army went north under the generalship of Sung Yi, with Shang Yu second in command. The other, led by Liu Peng, headed straight toward Qin. The target was the kingdom's splendid capital, Shangyang. And Shang Yu, ever violent and impatient, could not stand the idea that Liu Peng would get to Shangyang first, and perhaps would assume command of the entire army. At one point on the northern front, Shang's commander, Sung Yi, hesitated in sending his troops into battle. Furious, Shang entered Sung Yi's tent, proclaimed him a traitor, cut off his head, and assumed sole command of the army. Without waiting for orders, he left the northern front and marched directly on Shangyang. He felt certain he was the better soldier and general than Liu, but to his utter astonishment, his rival, leading a smaller, swifter army, managed to reach Shangyang first. Shang had an advisor, Fan Seng, who warned him, "This village headman, Liu Meng, used to be greedy only for riches and women. But since entering the capital, he has not been led astray by wealth, wine, or sex. That shows he is aiming high." Fan Seng urged Shang to kill his rival before it was too late. He told the general to invite the wily peasant to a banquet at their camp outside Shangyang, and, in the midst of a celebratory sword dance, to have his head cut off. The invitation was sent. Liu fell for the trap and came to the banquet. But Shang hesitated in ordering the sword dance, and by the time he gave the signal, Liu had sensed a trap and managed to escape. "Bah!" cried Fan Seng in disgust, seeing that Shang had botched the plot. "One cannot plan with a simpleton. Liu Meng will steal your empire yet, and make us all his prisoners." Realizing his mistake, Shang hurriedly marched on Shangyang, this time determined to hack off his rival's head. Liu was never one to fight when the odds were against him, and he abandoned the city. Shang captured Shangyang, murdered the young prince of Qin, and burned the city to the ground. Liu was now Shang's bitter enemy, and he pursued him for many months, finally cornering him in a walled city. Lacking food, his army in disarray, Liu sued for peace. Again Fan Seng warned Shang, "Crush him now! If you let him go again, you will be sorry later." But Shang decided to be merciful. He wanted to bring Liu back to Chu alive, and to force his former friend to acknowledge him as master. But Fan proved right. Liu managed to use the negotiations for his surrender as a distraction, and he escaped with a small army. Shang, amazed that he had yet again let his rival slip away, once more set out after Liu, this time with such ferocity that he seemed to have lost his mind. At one point, having captured Liu's father in battle, Shang stood the old man up during the fighting and yelled to Liu across the line of troops, "Surrender now, or I shall boil your father alive." Liu calmly answered, "But we are sworn brothers, so my father is your father also. If you insist on boiling your own father, send me a bowl of the soup. Shang backed down, and the struggle continued. A few weeks later, in the thick of the hunt, Shang scattered his forces unwisely, and in a surprise attack, Liu was able to surround his main garrison. For the first time, the tables were turned. Now it was Shang who sued for peace. Liu's top advisor urged him to destroy Shang, crush his army, show no mercy. To let him go would be like rearing a tiger. It will devour you later, the advisor said. Liu agreed. Making a false treaty, he lured Shang into relaxing his defense, then slaughtered almost all of his army. Shang managed to escape. Alone and on foot, knowing that Liu had put a bounty on his head, he came upon a small group of his own retreating soldiers and cried out, I hear Liu Peng has offered 1,000 pieces of gold and a fief of 10,000 families for my head. Let me do you a favor. Then he slit his own throat and died. Interpretation. Shang Yu had proven his ruthlessness on many an occasion. He rarely hesitated in doing away with a rival if it served his purposes. But with Liu Bang, he acted differently. He respected his rival. He did not want to defeat him through deception. He wanted to prove his superiority on the battlefield, even to force the clever Liu to surrender and to serve him. Every time he had his rival in his hands, something made him hesitate. A fatal sympathy with, or respect for, the man who, after all, had once been a friend and comrade in arms. But the moment Shang made it clear that he intended to do away with Liu, yet failed to accomplish it, he sealed his own doom. Liu would not suffer the same hesitation once the tables were turned. This is the fate that faces all of us when we sympathize with our enemies, when pity or the hope of reconciliation makes us pull back from doing away with them. We only strengthen their fear and hatred of us. We have beaten them, and they are humiliated. Yet we nurture these resentful vipers who will one day kill us. Power cannot be dealt with this way. It must be exterminated, crushed, and denied the chance to return to haunt us. This is all the truer with a former friend who has become an enemy. The law governing fatal antagonisms reads, "Reconciliation is out of the question. Only one side can win, and it must win totally." Liu Bang learned this lesson well. After defeating Shang Yu, this son of a farmer went on to become supreme commander of the armies of Chu. Crushing his next rival, the king of Chu, his own former leader, he crowned himself emperor, defeated everyone in his path, and went down in history as one of the greatest rulers of China. The immortal Han Gaozu, founder of the Han Dynasty. As Cotilia said, those who seek to achieve things should show no mercy. Observance of the Law. Wu Zhao, born in 625 AD, was the daughter of a duke, and as a beautiful young woman of many charms, she was accordingly attached to the harem of Emperor Taizong. The imperial harem was a dangerous place, full of young concubines vying to become the emperor's favorite. Wu's beauty and forceful character quickly won her this battle, but knowing that the emperor, like other powerful men, is a creature of whim, and that she could easily be replaced, she kept her eye on the future. Wu managed to seduce the emperor's dissolute son, Gaozong, on the only possible occasion when she could find him alone, while he was relieving himself at the royal urinal. Even so, when the emperor died and Gaozong took over the throne, she still suffered the fate to which all wives and concubines of a deceased emperor were bound by tradition and law. Her head shaven, she entered a convent for what was supposed to be the rest of her life. For 7 years, Wu schemed to escape. By communicating in secret with the new emperor, and by befriending his wife, the empress, she managed to get a highly unusual royal edict, allowing her to return to the palace and to the royal harem. Once there, she fawned on the empress, while still sleeping with the emperor. The empress didn't discourage this. She had yet to provide the emperor with an heir. Her position was vulnerable, and Wu was a valuable ally. In 654, Wu Zhao gave birth to a child. One day the Empress came to visit, and as soon as she had left, Wu smothered the newborn, her own baby. When the murder was discovered, suspicion immediately fell on the Empress, who had been on the scene moments earlier and whose jealous nature was known by all. This was precisely Wu's plan. Shortly thereafter, the Empress was charged with murder and executed. Wu Zhao was crowned Empress in her place. Her new husband, addicted to his life of pleasure, gladly gave up the reins of government to Wu Zhao, who was from then on known as Empress Wu. Although now in a position of great power, Wu hardly felt secure. There were enemies everywhere. She could not let down her guard for one moment. Indeed, when she was 41, she began to fear that her beautiful young niece was becoming the emperor's favorite. She poisoned the woman with a clay mixed into her food. In 675, her own son, touted as the heir apparent, was poisoned as well. The next eldest son, illegitimate but now the crown prince, was exiled a little later on trumped-up charges. And when the emperor died in 683, Wu managed to have the son after that declared unfit for the throne. All this meant that it was her youngest, most ineffectual son who finally became emperor. In this way, she continued to rule. Over the next 5 years, there were innumerable palace coups. All of them failed, and all of the conspirators were executed. By 688, there was no one left to challenge Wu. She proclaimed herself a divine descendant of Buddha, and in 690, her wishes were finally granted. She was named Holy and Divine Emperor of China. Wu became emperor because there was literally nobody left from the previous Tang Dynasty. And so she ruled unchallenged for over a decade of relative peace. In 705, at the age of 80, she was forced to abdicate. Interpretation. All who knew Empress Wu remarked on her energy and intelligence. At the time, there was no glory available for an ambitious woman beyond a few years in the imperial harem, then a lifetime walled up in a convent. In Wu's gradual but remarkable rise to the top, she was never naive. She knew any hesitation, any momentary weakness would spell her end. If, every time she got rid of a rival, a new one appeared, the solution was simple. She had to crush them all or be killed herself. Other emperors before her had followed the same path to the top, but Wu, who as a woman had next to no chance to gain power, had to be more ruthless still. Empress Wu's 40-year reign was one of the longest in Chinese history. Although the story of her bloody rise to power is well known, in China she is considered one of the period's most able and effective rulers. A priest asked the dying Spanish statesman and general Ramon Maria Narvaez, 1800 to 1868, "Does Your Excellency forgive all your enemies?"
"I do not have to forgive my enemies," answered Narvaez. "I have had them all shot."
Keys to Power. It is no accident that the two stories illustrating this law come from China. Chinese history abounds with examples of enemies who were left alive and returned to haunt the lenient. Crush the enemy is a key strategic tenet of Sun Tzu, the 4th century BC author of The Art of War. The idea is simple. Your enemies wish you ill. There is nothing they want more than to eliminate you. If in your struggles with them you stop halfway, or even three-quarters of the way, out of mercy or hope of reconciliation, you will only make them more determined, more embittered, and they will someday take revenge. They may act friendly for the time being, but this is only because you have defeated them. They have no choice but to bide their time. The solution? Have no mercy. Crush your enemies as totally as they would crush you. Ultimately, the only peace and security you can hope for from your enemies is their disappearance. Mao Zedong, a devoted reader of Sun Tzu and of Chinese history generally, knew the importance of this law. In 1934, the communist leader and some 75,000 poorly equipped soldiers fled into the desolate mountains of western China to escape Chiang Kai-shek's much larger army, in what has since been called the Long March. Chiang was determined to eliminate every last communist, and by a few years later, Mao had less than 10,000 soldiers left. By 1937, in fact, when China was invaded by Japan, Jiang calculated that the communists were no longer a threat. He chose to give up the chase and concentrate on the Japanese. 10 years later, the communists had recovered enough to rout Jiang's army. Jiang had forgotten the ancient wisdom of crushing the enemy. Mao had not. Jiang was pursued until he and his entire army fled to the island of Taiwan. Nothing remains of his regime in mainland China to this day. The wisdom behind crushing the enemy is as ancient as the Bible. Its first practitioner may have been Moses, who learned it from God himself, when he parted the Red Sea for the Jews, then let the water flow back over the pursuing Egyptians so that not so much as one of them remained. When Moses returned from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and found his people worshipping the golden calf, he had every last offender slaughtered. And just before he died, he told his followers, finally about to enter the Promised Land, that when they had defeated the tribes of Canaan, they should utterly destroy them, make no covenant with them, and show no mercy to them. The goal of total victory is an axiom of modern warfare, and was codified as such by Karl von Clausewitz, the premier philosopher of war. Analyzing the campaigns of Napoleon, von Clausewitz wrote, "We do claim that direct annihilation of the enemy's forces must always be the dominant consideration. Once a major victory is achieved, there must be no talk of rest, of breathing space, but only of the pursuit, going for the enemy again, seizing his capital, attacking his reserves, and anything else that might give his country aid and comfort." The reason for this is that after war come negotiation and the division of territory. If you have only won a partial victory, you will inevitably lose in negotiation what you have gained by war. The solution is simple. Allow your enemies no options. Annihilate them, and their territory is yours to carve. The goal of power is to control your enemies completely, to make them obey your will. You cannot afford to go halfway. If they have no options, they will be forced to do your bidding. This law has applications far beyond the battlefield. Negotiation is the insidious viper that will eat away at your victory. So give your enemies nothing to negotiate, no hope, no room to maneuver. They are crushed, and that is that. Realize this. In your struggle for power, you will stir up rivalries and create enemies. There will be people you cannot win over, who will remain your enemies no matter what. But whatever wound you inflicted on them, deliberately or not, do not take their hatred personally. Just recognize that there is no possibility of peace between you, especially as long as you stay in power. If you let them stick around, they will seek revenge as certainly as night follows day. To wait for them to show their cards is just silly. As Empress Wu understood, by then it will be too late. Be realistic. With an enemy like this around, you will never be secure. Remember the lessons of history and the wisdom of Moses and Mao. Never go halfway. It is not, of course, a question of murder. It is a question of banishment. Sufficiently weakened and then exiled from your court forever, your enemies are rendered harmless. They have no hope of recovering, insinuating themselves, and hurting you. And if they cannot be banished, at least understand that they are plotting against you and pay no heed to whatever friendliness they feign. Your only weapon in such a situation is your own wariness. If you cannot banish them immediately, then plot for the best time to act. Reversal. This law should very rarely be ignored, but it does sometimes happen that it is better to let your enemies destroy themselves, if such a thing is possible, than to make them suffer by your hand. In warfare, for example, a good general knows that if he attacks an army when it is cornered, its soldiers will fight much more fiercely. It is sometimes better, then, to leave them an escape route, a way out. As they retreat, they wear themselves out, and are ultimately more demoralized by the retreat than by any defeat he might inflict on the battlefield. When you have someone on the ropes, then, but only when you are sure they have no chance of recovery, you might let them hang themselves. Let them be the agents of their own destruction. The result will be the same, and you won't feel half as bad. Finally, sometimes by crushing an enemy, you embitter them so much that they spend years and years plotting revenge. The Treaty of Versailles had such an effect on the Germans. Some would argue that in the long run, it would be better to show some leniency. The problem is your leniency involves another risk. It may embolden the enemy, which still harbors a grudge, but now has some room to operate. It is almost always wiser to crush your enemy. If they plot revenge years later, do not let your guard down, but simply crush them again. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Kautilya, Indian philosopher. The remnants of an enemy can become active, like those of a disease or fire. Hence, these should be exterminated completely. One should never ignore an enemy, knowing him to be weak. He becomes dangerous in due course, like the spark of fire in a haystack. From The Borgias by Ivan Klula. The Trap at Sinigalia. On the day Ramiro was executed, Cesare Borgia quit Cesena, leaving the mutilated body on the town square, and marched south. 3 days later, he arrived at Fano, where he received the envoys of the city of Ancona, who assured him of their loyalty. A messenger from Vitellozzo Vitelli announced that the little Adriatic port of Sinigalia had surrendered to the condottiere, mercenary soldiers. Only the citadel, in the charge of Genoese Andrea Doria, still held out, and Doria refused to hand it over to anyone except Cesare himself. Borgia sent word that he would arrive the next day, which was just what the condottiere wanted to hear. Once he reached Sinigalia, Cesare would be an easy prey, caught between the citadel and their forces ringing the town. The condottiere were sure they had military superiority, believing that the departure of the French troops had left Cesare with only a small force. In fact, according to Machiavelli, Borgia had left Cesena with 10,000 infantrymen and 3,000 horse, taking pains to split up his men so that they would march along parallel routes before converging on Sinigalia. The reason for such a large force was that he knew from a confession extracted from Ramiro de Lorca what the condottieri had up their sleeve. He therefore decided to turn their own trap against them. This was the masterpiece of trickery that the historian Paolo Jovio later called the Magnificent Deceit. At dawn on December 31st, 1502, Cesare reached the outskirts of Sinigalia. Led by Micheletto Corella, Cesare's advance guard of 200 lances took up its position on the canal bridge. This control of the bridge effectively prevented the conspirators' troops from withdrawing. Cesare greeted the condottieri effusively and invited them to join him. Michelotto had prepared the Palazzo Bernardino for Cesare's use, and the Duke invited the condottieri inside. Once indoors, the men were quietly arrested by guards who crept up from the rear. Cesare gave orders for an attack on Vitelli's and Orsini's soldiers in the outlying areas. That night, while their troops were being crushed, Micheletto throttled Oliveretto and Vitelli in the Bernardino Palace. At one fell swoop, Borgia had got rid of his former generals and worst enemies. And from Napoleon Bonaparte, "To have ultimate victory, you must be ruthless."